You're listening to a Drishti Point podcast. I am so thrilled and excited to be here on the phone with Sharon Gannon. Sharon Gannon is a well-known yogi, most well-known for being the founder of Jiva Mukti Yoga, and she's here in Vancouver, and I'm so excited to have you to talk about yoga, and specifically Jiva Mukti Yoga and the ways that we can use our yoga practice as a way to bring happiness for all beings. And I know the Jiva Mukti method sees that in a very particular way. Sharon, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be speaking with you, Farah.
So tell me a little bit about what, for people who may not know, what distinguishes Jiva Mukti Yoga from other schools of yoga?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I tend not to like to look for differences. To me, it's more exciting to look for similarities, but I have to perhaps take other people's word for it, their observations about what makes Jiva Mukti distinctive, and that would probably be, we have five tenets, which mm-hmm. form the foundational principles for our method, and one of those tenets is animal rights, ahimsa, veganism, and another one is the study of scriptures, Sanskrit scriptures, mm-hmm. and an emphasis on music, and emphasis on meditation. So these are, we do, of course, emphasize asana, but we emphasize asana as a way to purify our karma, because we view the body as storehouses of our karmas. So we emphasize remembering God, devotion to God, and being kind to others as the two important practices that would bring about yoga being enlightenment.
Now, for people who might not be familiar with what it means to eat a sattvic diet or the effect of food on our bodies and on our consciousness, can you speak a little bit about how important the things that we use to nourish ourselves have an impact on all levels of our being?
Yes. We do follow the teachings of yoga, and in the Bhagavad Gita, we're told that if you want to be a yogi, if you want enlightenment, if you want to experience limitless, boundless joy, then you should bring joy and happiness to others. And, of course, that is very much aligned with the vegan diet. And the SAD diet, the standard American diet of meat and dairy products, SAD meaning SAD, Standard American Diet, mm-hmm. which is actually a global phenomena, and not just in America. It doesn't lead to more happiness. It doesn't lead to more joy. It certainly doesn't lead to enlightenment. It promotes more suffering, certainly for the animals involved, but of course, human beings who are eating animals and consuming dairy products. It's a proven fact that the major diseases that are plaguing human beings today can be traced to diet of meat and dairy products, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, et cetera, the list goes on. And, of course, there's so much suffering in this world. There's so much violence in this world. And most of it seems to be out of our control as individuals. But what we choose to eat is definitely within our control. So I think when you have a choice, it is always better to choose kindness over cruelty. And a vegan diet is simply the most simplest choice to promote more kindness in the world and to lessen the amount of suffering and violence.
Now, you've been a vegan for a long time. Can you think back to when you first made that decision, and the Can you speak personally about what impact it made on your own life and your own journey and your own practice and your own way of seeing the world?
Yes. Thank you for being interested. I've been a vegan for about 30 years now. In 1982, I saw a film, a documentary film, a feature-length documentary film. It was a British film, and it was titled The Animals Film. And I went, not because I was an animal rights activist or a vegan, I wasn't at the time, but I went because I was a musician, an artist, and I saw on the poster at the movie theater that the soundtrack was by Robert Wyatt. Robert Wyatt is a British musician who is not too popular these days, but he was very popular in my generation. And I really admired him, and also Talking Heads. David Byrne did some of the songs that Robert Wyatt organized and arranged for the film. And so I went because I saw Robert Wyatt, his name on the marquee. And the film was also narrated by a very popular actress at the time, Julie Christie. And so I thought, wow, any film where Robert Wyatt is associated, it must be something we're seeing. And so that's why I went. And I spent 2 hours plus minutes in that movie theater. And when I left, I was never the same. It was really the life-changing experience. And what I saw depicted in that film was the various ways that we human beings are exploiting and enslaving animals for our own temporary purposes. And it showed how animals are exploited and enslaved for food, for the entertainment industries, for medical research, for military research, for clothing, et cetera, et cetera. And never before had graphic depictions, you know, inside farms and slaughterhouses and research facilities. They hadn't been all put together and shown in such a way before. And so it was quite revealing and to see the reality depicted like this. And I vowed when I came out of that movie theater, I actually was walking down the street going to a band rehearsal. And I just got down on my knees and lifted up my arms, and I asked God to make me an instrument so that I could contribute in some way to stopping the insanity I saw depicted in that film. And of course, shortly after, I became a vegan. Shortly after that, I became an animal rights activist, and shortly after that, I became a yoga teacher, because I found in the philosophy of yoga and the methodology, it gave me a platform for speaking up for the animals and to speak out for kindness and compassion. And so then my life unfolded after that, and here I am.
Now, that's such a beautiful and poignant moment. And I'd like to come to that moment, because I was recently reading your story in the book, How Do You Pray? And wanted to ask you, you know, in moments when you see injustice or violence, or where you see tragedy and suffering, how do you connect with God? How do you pray?
I ask God for guidance. I have a mantra that I say all the time, asking that I would be able to find the solution through contacting the source of love itself, which is God. In the yogic scriptures, God is defined as Satchit, but mostly Ananda, which means bliss, happiness. So if I do feel any anger or resentment towards the suffering that I see, I quickly try to let go of that, because that's not productive to the ultimate aim. the ultimate aim is to eradicate the negativity and to allow joy and happiness to permeate. And so I don't judge. I'm not an angry vegan. I'm not a judgmental vegan. I try to cultivate compassion, not just for the animals, but for the people who are eating animals, the people who are ignorantly promoting and condoning and supporting the continued exploitation and enslavement of animals, because I know through my studies of yoga that those human beings will become those animals in a short amount of time. So because of karma, how karma works. And so I don't see any sense in showing compassion for the souls that are in the forms of the animals now and not showing compassion for the souls that are in the form of human beings who are hurting those animals. So compassion, I feel, should be limitless. And I think through compassion and love, we can solve the terrible problems of the world.
Now,
so not through blaming or complaining, but through showing love and kindness to everyone involved.
Mm-hmm. I'm aware that you had the great honor of teaching yoga to Geshe Michael and Lama Christie when they were on a 3-year meditation retreat, and I wanted to ask you how teachings of Tibetan Buddhism or teachings outside of yoga have had an effect on the way that you view the world and the way that you practice.
Oh, okay. First of all, Geshe Michael Roach, in my humble opinion, is an enlightened being. And when he came to me seeking to be taught yoga, I felt very honored. And I didn't know very much at all about Tibetan Buddhism or Buddhism in general, but I was very much immersed in yoga. And so when I started to hear him give teachings of emptiness, I said, hey, this is very much like yoga. And I showed him, I brought him a copy of the Yoga Sutra, which had been translated by my Guruji, Sri Brahmananda Saraswati. And I said, look, in the fourth chapter, it says, there's this lovely teaching, this sutra that says, Vastu samye chitta vedat tayor vibhaktaha pansaha. And the translation of that says, each individual person perceives the same object or person or situation in a different way according to their own state of mind and projections. Everything is empty according from its own side and appears according to how we see it. So there you have it, which is like the teachings of shunyata, teachings of emptiness, which are foundation teachings in the yogic scriptures. And of course, Tibetan Buddhism has taken those teachings and made a whole school, the mind-only school. And of course, we find these teachings of shunyata, emptiness, you know, they're not just in Tibetan Buddhism. So I don't know if I was influenced by Tibetan Buddhism. I saw that there was such an alignment of Tibetan Buddhism with the Yoga Sutras, which actually predate Tibetan Buddhism. And so I think we were copacetic. You know, we were on the same page mm-hmm. with these ideas that, I mean, I follow the teachings of the Pushti Marg. The Pushti Marg comes from Willabhacharya. Willabhacharya was one of the five great acharyas of Vedanta or yogic teachings in India, and Willabhacharya lived in the 1500s, and he definitely, his teachings I came to know about through Shamdas, a great, great spiritual master who was my spiritual teacher and also my dear friend. And Willabhacharya, his teachings are distinct because, unlike the other acharyas before him, who, well, all the Acharyas agree that God alone is real. The ultimate reality is God, and the nature of God is Satchit Ananda, truth, consciousness, and mostly bliss. But where they differ is their perception of the world. And those other Acharyas basically have a negative worldview and feel that the world should be renounced, and that the yogi or the one seeking enlightenment should have nothing to do with the world, and they should become renunciates and not get involved with women or money or the world, you know. But Willibacharya had a different take on it, and he said, the world is not bad. It's a perceptual thing. It's in the mind. If you do see something wrong in the world, know that it's not in the world. That is, it's in your perception. And so the teachings of yoga say that the practices of yoga can help you to shift your perception and to see that the world is coming from you. And so if you want to see a different world, then change the way that you relate to the world, change your actions, change your karmas. And so certainly those teachings are in alignment with the teachings of Patanjali and with Tibetan Buddhism. So, yeah, does that answer your question?
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, most of us on this path, we try to practice every moment of the day, but do you have a formal practice or a formal sadhana, or are there certain things that you commit to on a daily basis that really help you to root and connect with God?
Yes. In the morning, I meditate. I do seva. Seva is a practice where you take care of God. you bathe God, you feed God, you get God up in the morning, you dress God, you talk to God, you offer your day to God, you remember God throughout the day, and you don't do anything without first offering it to God. So I practice that. I wouldn't even take a sip of water without first mentally or even out loud. Sometimes if I don't want to cause too much attention, but I offer it to God first. So whatever I do, eating, drinking, taking a walk, going to visit friends, whatever, if I'm going to engage in a conversation with anybody, I first silently offer it to God, and in hopes that the experience would enhance the world, enhance the lives of others, and increase God's bliss in this world. So, yes, that is my, I suppose that's my main practice, the remembrance of God. Yeah.
It's been so wonderful to speak with you, Sharon. Is there anything about Vancouver that touched you as you've, you know, done the workshops and met local people who are on the path?
Yes. My beloved student, Tina James, who teaches in Vancouver and also has a center, a Jivamukti center in Whistler, I'm very inspired by her courage, her uncompromising animal rights activism and vegan activism, and the joy that she has in teaching, and the love and the caring that she has for her students is quite exceptional. She really cares for her students, at times even more than her own self. And so she is a great example of compassion and wisdom in action. So actually, it is her, Tina, who brought me here to Vancouver and Whistler. That's why I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do hope that you will come back. Then it won't be the first time that you visit Vancouver and connect with the community here. And it's been a real pleasure to speak with you and connect with you over internet. And I look forward if we have the opportunity to meet in person.
So far, I do want to acknowledge the amazing, wonderful work that you are doing with this podcast. Truly, truly incredible. And thank you so much. And you're enriching so many people's lives and bringing these teachings, these ancient teachings, which are so relevant at this time of great global crisis and consciousness shift. So bless you, bless you.